T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world tonight. I want to thank you for taking time from your valuable schedule to join me. I have a very interesting guest today. People know that I do a lot of work on contact, which I believe is the people you got to talk to. And tonight I have a scientist who has made contact and has written a book called A Scientist's Own Alien Abduction Encounters. And his first name is Bruce, and I'll let him introduce himself, and then we're going to go into why a PhD would get involved into something like UFOs, and we'll go from there. So good evening, Bruce, and thank you for being willing to share with my audience your story of contact.
Grant, it's great to be with you. I just wanted to point out that again, my name is Dr. Bruce Rapuano. The title of my book is, oddly enough, Dominion Lost.
Oh, yeah,
right. Scientist's Own Alien Abduction Encounters. Actually, I have two books out. One is a 450-page book where I do delve into quite a bit of scientific analysis of my encounters. And an abridged version that gives the reader almost exclusively what my experiences were and where I describe in detail what happened to me, with a not so much in-depth scientific analysis. So the reader can pick whichever version might be more appealing to them. And I actually began this journey maybe 30 years ago when a lot of the talk of alien abduction and contact was blossoming up in the UFO abduction literature. The work of Bud Hopkins was very provocative, the late Harvard psychiatrist Dr. John Mack, and one of their colleagues, David Jacobs, who was a history professor at Temple University. And at that time in the mid-80s, Whitley Strieber published Communion, which was widely read and also showed some similarities to the other abduction accounts that had been written about by the UFO abduction investigators that, you know, I had mentioned. But at that time, I became quite shocked and even alarmed that in reading these books, I realized that I had had many of the experiences, in fact, almost all of the experiences that the quote unquote UFO abductees had been relating to the investigators, whether they consciously recall these experiences, which a lot of them did, or remembered only after submitting to some type of regressive hypnosis. And I could really check pretty much every box in the core abduction scenario and had to realize that by far the best model for explaining what had happened to me throughout my life was UFO alien abduction. I didn't know what to do about it, because I was right in the middle, or actually closer to the start of my career as a biomedical research scientist. And I just obtained a position at the most well-known and probably most reputable cancer research center in the country, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, started a postdoctoral training program funded by the NIH. And didn't know how I could make my story public at that time, at that point in my career, without damaging my chances of pursuing my passion, to which was to be a medical research scientist. Then now, at the time of my life and career where I'm much more established, I feel it's important for people like myself, and I know there are many scientists, engineers, doctors, lawyers, quote-unquote professional people that have had these experiences, to come forward, and in doing so, encourage other professional people to come forward and tell their stories, because I think it's very important at this time where we're seeing, I believe, an acceleration in the number of reportings of UFOs, not only in North America but throughout the world. And we're also anticipating an impending disclosure, particularly from the U.S. government, that I felt it's important to tell my story at this juncture, and hopefully start, if not an impetus that would make this disclosure by the government more likely, but maybe prompt individuals to reveal what they've experienced, and that might represent a form of disclosure, especially if it's coming from a group of individuals that have perhaps a lot of credibility because they're scientists or professionals. And that's really, in a nutshell, the reason why I wrote the book.
So you're a research scientist. Is there no tenure type thing, or did you have a risk of
being demoted or moved? At this point, I'm really at the end of my career.
Oh, okay.
And it's not something I'm concerned about. I think, if I get a lot of bad publicity as a result of writing the book, which really hasn't happened yet, I think it's something I could walk away with, but it's much more important to me to get the message out.
Yeah, I think the days are gone of the after the New York Times article. I think it sort of switched around that you could legitimately talk about this and be considered sane. It's not like the old days where did your friend or your coworkers know during the period of time that you were in this kind of
Grant? No one knew. My coworkers, closest friends. No one in my family knew. I never found it comfortable enough to be able to explain what had happened to me to anyone, even when I realized that this had happened 20 or 30 years ago when I first made the realization. And I really haven't gotten any negative feedback at this point. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback from my family, even my spouse to know about it. But she's been very supportive. She has encouraged me to go on the podcasts, that have been kind enough to invite me to appear, to tell my story. And I have to say, the feedback I've gotten has been encouraging at this point. Nothing adverse so far.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is it's sort of overblown, the idea that people are going to get ridiculed and stuff. To me, it's when people do it, they suddenly find out that nobody really cares. I mean, it's not like it changes anybody's life. It's like, okay, that's fine. That's my reaction. And I got relatives and family that will listen to me, but they're really not going to go out and research or write a book or anything like that. It's sort of our job. So a question I always ask people who do experiencer books: did they tell you to, or ask you, encourage you to write the book? The entities that you're dealing with?
No. I actually, the book had already been published, and I had to explain to them, there's a book that's available on Amazon that I wrote, and this is what it's about. So really? I really surprised everyone. At least of the people closest to me. I think it was better just to let them be able to, once I explain the gist of my experiences, to be able to go online. And of course, I provided a lot of free copies to people in my family. I get the book, read it. It's the best way for you to understand exactly what happened to me.
Well, I was asking about the beings, like the beings that you're dealing with. Oh. Did they encourage you to?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about the word.
Because a lot of experiencers will. I mean, if you listen to Sherry Wilde when she talks about Da was her being. You know, she said, "Am I writing your damn book?" They kept saying, "No, the time is right. Timing is everything." And you always hear these stories. Did you get that encouragement that they want you to sort of spread the word and tell other people what's going on?
You know, it's enough that I didn't have any further contact that would discourage me.
Yeah,
I was concerned about that. I did think quite a bit about what if I initiated contact that resulted in me being told, don't write the book, don't finish the book, pull the book after it's been published. I was worried about that, but I haven't had any experiences that I would attribute to contact at all since the book has been published. I have to say no. So I would have to say no. There's been no encouragement, but no contact that I would say had... I would attribute to the publishing of the book.
Okay, now I messed up the title, Dominion Lost. Can you describe why you called the book that?
Well, you know, when I consider over the past 50, 60 years, the abundance of sightings of UFOs, of craft that clearly were manufactured by non-human beings, and the fact that they're in the atmosphere, in our skies, all over the world, in the oceans, underneath the oceans. There have been many reports and theories and books written about how there's a lot of evidence that there are bases where the aliens hide the UFOs from either other civilizations or from human beings in underground ocean bases. The implication of that for me is that we are sharing our planet, our skies, our oceans with non-human intelligence that operate technologies that are far advanced than our technologies are. And it's no longer legitimate that we can consider human beings to have total dominion over planet Earth when the frequency and the number of sightings of UFOs is such that we really can no longer claim to have dominion, in my opinion.
Now, sort of a two-part question. I guess the obvious question is what type of beings are you dealing with? And was there one particular being that did all the talking, or did you have contact with others, or was there any communication back and forth?
I've only encountered beings that fit the mold of the classic gray alien.
The tall and the small ones?
3.5 to 4 foot tall, small frame. Large, disproportionately large, hairless heads. Yeah. They were white in color, but again, they fit that anatomically. They fit the mold of the classic gray alien. I did have one encounter where in my bedroom, where I woke up to see one of them hovering over me, it looked like the alien was dematerializing into my room or out of my room, and appeared to have more of a gray color. That's the only being I've seen. Now, I did have one abduction experience where I believe I was on board a UFO on the proverbial table, examination table, in some type of quote unquote clinical or hospital setting. And in the middle of the abduction, was able to wake up and see what was going on around me. And then after a few seconds, not much more than that, I felt what I thought was a hand that, as a six-year-old, covered my entire chest and abdomen, that I thought could have been the hand of a being that was larger than the beings I was watching in front of me that were as a six-year-old no taller than I was. And I thought that might have been a larger being, but I never could see the being. But again, all my experiences are with what I would call the gray aliens.
And what's their encounters with you in the bedroom? Like, you had the one table experience. What were the others like? You mentioned the one hovering above the bed, or is that the encounters?
Yes, I had woken up, couldn't move. I happened to be at the edge of the bed, and my head was tilted to the right, and on my right I saw a being crouching down, and I later measured the height of the table lamp, because it seemed as if the being was standing where the table lamp was, and its head was no taller than the lamp portion of this piece of furniture. And when I measured it, it was actually 3.5 feet. So I knew that this was the same being, the same type of being I had seen previously during earlier encounters. And what was alarming was I could not see the hands of the being. I couldn't move, and I just felt, I caught an alien in the act of taking an implant out, putting an implant into me, or doing something having to do with my head, because it felt from my vantage point that the hands of the alien were near my head or behind my head. And at that point, the being disappeared. And that's all I remember of that particular encounter. But that was a close encounter that was really too close for comfort.
When did this all begin in terms of contact?
I remember, I have memories, and I explained I had one sense memory in the book where I was carried by my mother, and that kind of evoked a memory of being with the same type of beings, two in particular. One was holding my left hand, one was holding my right hand. I don't know where we were. But I also had a flood of associated memories that I knew these beings. They were people, like people I knew that were teaching me. I felt a mentorship type of relationship with them. And that was when I was probably no more than 2.5 to 3 years old. And I would say about 3 years after that, 3 or 4 years after that, is when I remember seeing a strange UFO, with a highly reflective surface, like aluminum or some type of metallic surface, outside my bedroom window near dusk. I thought it was an airplane. I thought I saw wings, but it looked like a very strange, the strangest airplane I'd ever seen, because the fuselage was much more rounded and had a much greater diameter compared to the wings. And that made me think it was a very strange looking craft. Fell asleep, and then that was when I woke up and saw the aliens when I was waking up, not in my bedroom anymore, where I'd been in my bed, but actually on an examination table. And I saw a group of 20 or 30 alien beings in front of me walking back and forth. And that was, I guess, the experience that I think most closely resembled the classic core abduction scenario, where you wake up in a hospital type of setting and you see alien beings, and it either intuitively or based on what happens during the encounter, the abductee feels that they're the subject of some type of experiment or undergoing some type of medical procedure. And that's how I felt. I really felt I had been in a hospital. I didn't know what type of hospital. I was attended to by some type of doctors. That's who I thought they were, but they were the most unusual doctors I'd ever seen. And my conclusion was that I did undergo some type of medical procedure, and the nature of which I really didn't know at the time.
Did it start with fear? Does that fit into the scenario? And did it become more acceptable as you went along?
Strangely enough, I never had any fear. I'm not sure why, whether or not I was, as a child, so curious about what's happening to me, or maybe the way I was treated by the aliens, But in that particular encounter that I just related to you, if anything, I felt anger or indignation at being taken out of my bedroom and being administered to by scientists or doctors. In fact, I even called out to them and tried to say, "You're not my doctors." In effect, what am I doing here? So I felt I was asserting myself. And in that instance and other instances, you know, I rarely felt any fear, except the fear of the one or two instances where during these encounters, I couldn't move. And the only fear I felt was that, you know, if I needed to run away, flee or fight, I had no control over my body. That was probably the only source of my fear during these encounters.
You referenced John Mack and Jacobs and the rest of them. Is there any family lineage going, you know, with parents having experiences? And did your wife know, in terms of when you would have experiences, did she sense you were gone or anything like that?
Well, I can't really recall anything concrete that's concrete in terms of experiences I've had since we've been married, I have strange dreams where she wakes me up and I think there's somebody, I don't know if they're people or beings, trying to enter our apartment, or I sometimes feel a weight on the bed being removed, like as if there was some animal or creature or being on the bed, but nothing like the experiences I report in the book, which occurred in my childhood and preteen years. And so I can't really say that there's anything during my married life that would enable me to ask my wife if anything strange had happened to me that she could relate, that I could attribute to an abduction experience.
Any marks or on your body, or scoop marks or triangles or that kind of thing? No.
It's the strangest thing to read a book. I think it was Missing Time by Bud Hopkins, and hear a nurse describe her theory about why one of the abductees was found to have a scoop mark run under the knee. It clearly looked like there was some type of surgical instrument that was introduced into the shin below the knee. And I have the exact type of scoop mark in the exact same position below my left knee. And her explanation was, according to Bud Hopkins, that it looked like a bone biopsy was performed on the tibia bone. And why that person has that scar and I have that scar, when none of us can remember any type of orthopedic procedure where a piece of bone was removed from you know, our leg, is quite remarkable. And I have another scar that again was identical to what's been reported in the abduction literature. When I was 7 years old, I just turned seven, I had my tonsils and adenoids removed. I had a series of ear infections that preceded the procedure, maybe going back for a year. So an ear, nose, and throat surgeon had, at the time of the surgery, found a scar in the back of my throat behind my nose. Actually, I'd asked my father about it, who had asked me, and I had told him I don't know how I got that scar. And there's a number of cases that have been reported in the abduction literature where, like myself, at the same age of 6 years old, the parents report that the child has unexplained nosebleeds, which I had. And in a couple of cases, and in one case in particular, there were two separate physicians that found the same type of scar I had in the nasopharynx, at the back of the throat, behind the nose. And then that also occur within a family, which not only the child, but the mother and I believe another generation, the grandparent, had also had experiences that would be consistent with alien abduction. So it's remarkably how closely similar some of my experiences, some of medical effects or physical signs that I associate with alien abduction, because I have no other explanation, no medical problem that I had that would have accounted for these medical symptoms, have been replicated throughout the abduction literature so closely in comparison to my experiences. And that's, learning about that is what prompted me to conclude that the abduction scenario is by far the best explanation for what had happened to me. Those physical, those examples of physical evidence that I, again, closely parallel to what others have reported.
It's kind of a wake up call compared to the dreams, where you're sort of getting the dreams, and it sort of says, no, this is for real. Like, you can't really deny it. Cause I wonder as well. And I'll ask you as a medical guy, what do you think is going on? Because if you the literature shows that people now, the big thing is triangles. So you come 1,000 light years across the galaxy, you put a triangle on somebody's arm, and the thing will go away in 24 hours or 48 hours. And it seems kind of weird. So as a medical guy, what do you think is going on?
Yeah, I haven't paid much attention because I haven't seen as many reports of that type of scar, the triangle scar. It's interesting because it's similar to the shape of the UFO. But I wonder why so many people, hundreds, thousands, particularly in America, not only are being abducted and seem to encounter the same beings, look anatomically the same, and the same type of quote-unquote clinical setting, and report that genetic material is being removed, either in the form of sperm or ova. This has happened so many times that abduction theorists have put forth the theory, a number of them, that there is some type of reproductive program ongoing, that they refer to them as hybrids, that somehow the aliens are creating a new race involving taking genetic material from human beings, perhaps altering the existing genes, human genes, or introducing alien DNA to form what are called alien-human hybrids. I like to call them instead, because I don't know if they were actually formed, that beings are being created as a result of sexual reproduction. Well, I like to call them transgenic human beings, a new species has been created by the aliens involving genetic material from human beings that has been modified chemically, genetically, in some way to create a new race. And that these beings, of course, because there's a very select number of genes that is being altered, or select numbers of sequences of DNA that have been introduced into the human genome, the resulting species looks exactly like us. They look no different than us. And abduction investigators have theorized that they're now walking among us. And, I wonder if this is part of a program that has something to do with either a non-human intelligence, an alien civilization trying to influence the course of our affairs, affect human destiny, or at some point exert some type of permanent control over human civilization. And I think that's what that's the theory that most of the evidence supports, in my opinion, that what's going on is that human beings are being abducted by aliens so that there can be some transformation of our species so that we can be better controlled. The other theory that I've entertained and others have discussed this as well, is that, you know, there may be a goal of either integration or some type of a plan so that non-human intelligences can interact with human beings. And the way to do this is that there must be some type of transformation in our genome and introduction of different genes so that human beings have the ability now, because perhaps they were not able to interact with and communicate with alien beings. But if we can be altered in some way to interact with and perceive aliens, perhaps in different dimensions, as a result of genetic engineering, this may be part of a plan for involving or with the goal of allowing our species to interact with another alien species for some purpose that we don't know.
Have you gotten any indication? You've got no sort of physical recollection, but do you have any indication that you may have children out there? Because a lot of, you know, the literature, that a lot of women are showing the child and the bond with the child, and they have to do this, and you haven't had any of those kind of experiences. Yeah, but I guess you must have thought about this, the fact that, you know,
so many women that claim to be abductees report this missing fetus syndrome, and they've been shown that, you know, hybrids that they feel or are told are actually their children. You know, I did have one encounter where I, in my preteen years, or I might've been 12 or 13, where I thought genetic material might've been removed. So I've thought about this. You know, it's not something pleasant to contemplate, because again, we don't know what the purpose of this reproductive program is. And, I talk in the book about also genetically engineered for a specific purpose, for a specific task by some master species. And, you know, they seem to be under the command or under the control of this master species. And, if these hybrids, if they do exist, are just instruments in some grand master plan. And to me, that it's not really pleasant to contemplate that, because, you know, we're that I have children that are they're my children, but they're really alien hybrid children. And I don't really, in that case, know what their fate is going to be under those circumstances. But I have thought about it to some degree.
Do you speculate, you know, based upon all the research you've done, on what the Greys appearing in 1961, why they showed up in 1961, why the beings before 61, you know, they look different, they're more human, or they have space helmets on, or have you gotten that sort of discussion in your book going, as to the different types of beings that are here? And you didn't have the experience, but you'll see people that it's almost like they're moving them from one being to another. First they see a Grey, then suddenly they see reptilians, then they see mantids, and it's almost like they're going from one being to another, as if they're being handed off in some sort of program that these beings are all working together. What's your take on all that kind of stuff?
I've only seen the Greys, but I'm very sympathetic to those views, because the Greys appear to behave as clones. They walk in unison. They seem to all look identical, and so they appear to be some race of drones that must have been created by a master race. Whether they're the Tall Whites, the Blue Syrians, the Arcturians, the Reptilians, I really have no evidence myself as to how many alien civilizations have been visiting this planet, who created the Greys, but I'm confident there has to be a dominant non-human intelligence that is certainly much more advanced than the Greys are. But I have no personal experience that would provide any evidence to support a theory that one particular alien civilization, the reptilians versus the Arcturians, is interacting with human beings more than another alien civilization. But I do think there has to be at least one or two more civilizations, one or two more species, I should say, alien species visiting the planet other than the Greys.
Okay. Now I forgot what the question I was going to ask you. In terms of the ship, you're talking a very nuts and bolts sort of approach to what's going on, but you did mention the fact that there was a Grey, I guess, floating above you and materializing, dematerializing. So can you go into that sort of thing? I mean, is this actually a straight out physical experience? Is this interdimensional? Have you speculated on what that means? Because even if you see it coming in and out of reality, it would indicate that there is this non-physical aspect to it as well.
Well, for to tell you the truth, for some reason, whether or not these beings originate in a different space and time than ours, in a parallel universe, or in our same contiguous universe, or in the same space and time that we occupy, but in another dimension of our universe, it's difficult to ascribe this experience of seeing alien beings materialize, dematerialize, or move through a wall in a bedroom to a technology, or to the fact that you're seeing interdimensional beings that have the ability to move from their dimension to our dimension and back. I don't have any bias either way, because I think it's possible what we're seeing is something that relies on a quantum teleportation, where the being may be in a UFO thousands or million miles away. He is able to teleport from that UFO to the Earth and back and forth almost instantaneously. I don't have any bias either way. There are a number of investigators that are convinced that the beings we're seeing, whether they're Greys or some other species, are interdimensionals. I have to say, I really don't know. Either is possible.
Yeah. Have you spoken to other experiences, and did they change your opinion based upon like feedback you've gotten from people? Because everybody, once you're known in the field, well, then people want to tell you their story. Have you gotten stuff that you've learned from other people that sort of backed up your story or gave you some insight as something you hadn't really realized?
I have had people contact me, scientists, very high level positions. Oh. I don't want to say where, that have had these experiences. Seeing a UFO of metallic construction, and then suddenly being on board the UFO, where they're having interactions with beings involving telepathic communication, which I've experienced. So yes, I've had some feedback from people that have read the book and gotten back to me that have kind of resonated with my experience. Their experiences resonate with mine. On the other hand, I've had others that have had none of these experiences. Professional people, highly educated people that were non-believers. Not only were they non-experiences, they were non-believers, but after reading the book have admitted their mind now is very open to the possibility. But you know, I do get feedback from people that have had experiences similar to mine. Others not so similar, but clearly indicate that something is going on where they've had some interaction with some type of experience that is, you know, transcends normal human experience.
Now, you mentioned high level people. Do you think the government is one of the statements they had made is because we cannot control the phenomena, we watch those that the phenomena affects. Lights in the sky have limited information capacity or something like that. Maybe as a theory, do you think the government is gradually dripping this thing out? And do you think that they have interest in you or other experiencers that you've got an indication? Because that's what, if you're a guy who's got a PhD and a background in medicine and stuff like that, it would make sense that people that would be trying to figure out in the government that may not know any more than you and I are watching people like you. Do you think that's going on? And what do you think of the present government disclosure? Do you think it's just whistleblowers coming forward, or do you think the government is actually sending these people out?
I don't give our governments that much credit that they have an organized program that's legitimately studying the phenomenon, where they've attracted enough qualified scientists to come together from various disciplines and study every aspect of this phenomenon. Therefore, I don't think they're interested in my story at present. As to why we're hearing hints of disclosure or having some individuals come forward with secondhand information, I don't know. One or two of the Navy pilots have firsthand information, and based on what they've seen in terms of when they're up in the air. I don't think the whistleblowers that have come forward are part of any planned government disclosure. I think it's haphazard. I don't think, you know, I get conflicting, I notice conflicting signals from people. Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick quits his job as head of the Anomaly Resolution Office and dissociates himself from anything the whistleblowers are saying. So it's, you know, if this is part of a government plan of disclosure, it appears that one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing. So it's really hard for me to respond to that, because what I'm seeing is not encouraging in with respect to the likelihood of disclosure coming from the American government in the next few months or years. I hope I'm wrong.
I can tell you from my experience, I was highly shocked that we got this far. It used to be a lot worse in terms of,
yes,
you know, government even using the word. They basically, and you could sort of understand it in your medical field. I mean, you have your little medical thing, but you don't know what's going on in the lab next to you, or, you know, it's like, it's this compartmentalized, and then who in the government is actually going to study this kind of stuff? It's like the agriculture department says, leave me alone, get it out of here. The people that might be working on biomedical stuff, it's like, leave me out of this. I mean, this isn't my job. And so you can sort of see the backlash in terms of people that you probably have run into, that people who you think that they may be covering up, and they just simply do not believe. No matter, you could be the smartest guy in the world, but you have these belief systems that are innate in you, and you can't turn some people around.
Yes, and I'm even more surprised than you are that they've allowed these whistleblowers to come forward and other people to write books and then discuss these matters. I think you know, the government knows a lot more. And I just think they're too afraid to let other governments know what they know. That's my take.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my particular take.
Beautiful. Yeah. Because you have the situation where, you know, it's like a game of cards where everybody wants somebody else to put their cards down and tell them what they know. And you know, it's kind of a unique mystery. Let me ask you, why you? The $64,000 question. Have you thought about that? And you got any speculation why you were picked?
You know, I'm going to go back and apologize to you because I didn't respond properly to a question you asked about this, the multi-generational aspect of this phenomenon. Okay. I don't want to get into it in great detail.
Yeah.
But you know, I feel that in my family there is some evidence that my grandfather was involved. He had a medical issue that was very, very similar to what abductees have, myself in particular, that might have resulted from a nasal implant. You know, so I think, you know, we have there's a lot of evidence, and I have a lot of evidence, you know, at least in terms of my own family, that this is a multi-generational phenomenon that the alien beings are concerned with bloodlines. And
so what's your blood type?
As a biologist, what we do is when we study particular gene and we want to manipulate the genes, see how it interacts with other genes, we'll work with a species of mice or a species of rats that have a specific genome, so we can control for the other genes, and in order to see how they interact with the gene that we want to modify. So we're concerned with the bloodline of this species that we're experimenting on. I think that's what's happening here, that there may be something in the bloodline of the abductees that is conducive to the type of genetic experiments that they're doing. I have no idea what the alien species is focusing on, whether they're examining bloodlines in which there are genes that might confer a trait of being able to communicate telepathically with the aliens, or perceive them in their environment, perceive them in their dimension. There may be something peculiar to those, to the genetic endowment of those particular bloodlines that allow the aliens to interact with them, or that's conducive to the types of experiments they want to do, where their intention is to modify the human genome. So that's my particular theory. I think other investigators have also discussed that theory as well.
Okay, now Jim Semivan talks about this idea that the government is covering up, but so are the beings. So he tells the story.
Yes.
They'll play with you. They'll prod you, but they'll never take you home to meet the family. And so the question I guess I would have is, if you had to ask a question, what would you want the beings to tell you? And why do you think there's the secrecy in the program with the beings? Why do you think they're doing basically what the government's doing? They're letting you know that they're there, like they appear in your bedroom. And I always wonder, like, why do people wake up? Like, why do they sort of wake you up so you can see them? And on the other hand, they're playing this sort of cover up game that you really don't know what's going on. And well, what's that all about?
Well, a lot, you know, as I point out in the book, either there's a technology involved or an innate capability that the aliens have, biological capability that allows them to use deception to hide their presence, hide what they're doing, sometimes even hide their appearance. They clearly don't want us to know what their agenda is. So you ask me what question I would ask them. Why are you taking genetic material? Why are you trying to create a new transgenic human species? What's the purpose of these biological experiments, and how does it benefit the human race? If not, how does it benefit your race?
Yeah.
Those are the questions uppermost on my mind.
Yeah, but then this leads to the question of, I mean, if they don't want you knowing what's going on, why do they appear? Because if they could block your, like your, most of your memory is blocked as to how many times you were on board the ship and stuff like that. If they can block it, why don't they block it all? Like, this is my question I always ask is why do they wake up somebody and say, wake up, and then go back to sleep again? And they sort of let you know that they're there. And then the sort of this secret game starts, but they do actually let you know that you're involved. They're giving these little breadcrumbs that sort of get you there, and you're writing books about it, and I'm writing books. So that's my sort of question is, why did they do, and maybe you don't have a theory, why did they do
maybe they don't care, Grant. They break into your house, and they're there to abduct you. They don't want anyone in government, anyone in power to know what they're doing, I think. And as soon as they appear, you know, they're using, as I say, some innate ability they have, or a technology like an implant, or they're projecting some type of energy that affects the human formation of human memory or retention of memories, so that there's no memory of, or as little memory as possible of what happens during the abduction. Now, with the hybrids, they may need to have the abductee, if they use genetic material from the abductee to create a hybrid child, they may need to have the child interact with the abductee, and at that point, need to have the abductee be conscious in order to be able to see the child, interact, perhaps communicate. That may be part of their agenda, but I think for the most part, certainly I can say in my case, 90 to 95% of what I believe happened to me has been erased from my memory. Everything I report in the book has been consciously recalled. I've never submitted to regressive hypnosis. And I think that's the case for a large majority of abductees. I don't think, and as I point out in the book, based on the way human memory forms and it can be retrieved, their technology may not be perfect in erasing 100% of what we experience during an abduction. And I've explained some of the biology behind that in the book. That's my only explanation why we can recall, meaning abductees can recall a small percentage of the abduction experience.
Okay. Yeah, and you mentioned before, maybe elaborate a little bit, you that they seem familiar. Do you think that you agree to this, that because you'll hear a lot of experiencers say that this is my family and I agreed to play this role and this is not what people think it is. Do you get that sense that
I know in many cases people feel this way. I never have. I can't attribute their feeling to anything other than a Stockholm syndrome. I don't know. I don't know.
You said they sounded familiar. Didn't you say they seemed like they were familiar to you?
Right. When I was two and a half, three years old, that's the only time I had that recollection that we had some type of relationship. Again, today, as I discuss in the book, I've concluded that probably is nothing more than a deception. I could be wrong, but that's how I feel today. It's in their interest, you know, to make the abductee feel comfortable, just as it's in my interest as a biologist to make a rabbit feel comfortable before I'm going to experiment on it. And there are a number of things we do to make them feel, more comfortable in a research setting. But I know a lot of abductees feel some type of allegiance to the aliens, to feel that they have some type of importance. They're part of a very important program, even to the point where there have been abductees that, based on neuroimaging, CT scan or MRI of the brain, have been demonstrated to still have implants in their brain, refuse to have them removed, not because they're afraid of the, you know, side effects of surgery, because that would be going against the aliens' agenda. I never subscribed to that sentiment or quote unquote political viewpoint.
But you may have implants because you have the bleeding nose thing. So you do admit that you may have an implant.
I admit that I may have had one.
Yeah.
Previously. Now I can't rule out that I have one now, but I can't rule out that it was only introduced, I'm assuming, into the nasal cavity or my brain for some particular experimental purpose. And that experimental program, at least as far as it involved me as a subject, may have been concluded. But I can't rule it out, what you said. Okay. I can't rule that out.
Okay. I don't know if you know the story of Tim Taylor from NASA, who's got 44 in patents. He claims he gets them from them. He has this contact protocol. Told me about the beings in his the hooded figure in his being in his room the night before he got this major invention that made millions and millions of dollars. And I said, could you see its face? No, I couldn't see its face. You mentioned telepathy. So what kind of experiences have you had in terms of interaction or telepathy? You mentioned that word, and this is a lot of people will mention this thing about the downloads with the, or that they're getting ideas and stuff like that. Have you had any of that kind of stuff?
Well, I have to, you know, refer to your work. I know you've talked about a lot in your work. I've had a much more limited interaction with the alien beings in terms of telepathic communication. I can remember, you know, it's in one or two cases where you feel like someone is eavesdropping on your internal dialogue and answering whatever questions you have in your mind. For example, when I'm on the exam table on board the UFO, and I see dozens of alien beings walking back in front of me, wondering for some reason, I'm 6 years old at the time, they all looked so identically alike. Are there boys and girls? And I hear that question. I can't say I hear it, but the question seems to be answered in my brain. Yes, they're both male and female. In another instance, I felt I had been abducted. It was in a situation where I woke up in my bed, couldn't move, and then heard a voice telling me, which I knew at that moment was not my voice, go back to sleep. So again, that's very limited example in my case of what I would call a telepathic communication. And one other example, at the time I had a nosebleed, heard a very strange communication, knew it was not my idea, knew it was not my voice, telling me, don't let them see the blood. That was not something I thought of. That's a specific detailed example of what I feel is a telepathic communication. But in terms of the scientist you were referring to that gets prolonged downloads or a lot of quote unquote scientific information that allows him to write patents, you know, I'd like to delve into that myself and read some of his work if he's published it. Because I would tend to believe it if I found a person that couldn't speak Norwegian, a Canadian who couldn't speak Norwegian can suddenly speak the language. Yeah. That's something that I as a scientist would not be able to explain.
Yeah, that would be extremely interesting. I can give you his email address. I don't know if he'll reply. He's what do they call him? The dragon. He's the head engineer at the space center, and he's trying to stay under the radar in terms of what he's doing. So, but it's an interesting.
Oh, you know, or I just want to interject there. You know, he's a scientist. He's an engineer. But I would like to see a history professor get a download so he could develop a grand unified theory that unites quantum physics with Einstein's general relativity, which he would never be able to do if he was a history professor.
Yeah.
You know, he would be able to, you know, certainly so he can write equations on the chalkboard if they're explained to him in the download. these are the types of things I speculate on that would persuade me that these downloads are real. If I'm being the devil's advocate, or, you know, this is just my nature as a scientist to ask these questions.
Yeah, I understand. I spent some time talking to Yvonne Smith. You probably have read some of her stuff in Los Angeles. I asked her, I said, Yvonne, how many experiencers that you worked with, how many of them have paranormal phenomena after their experience? And she started laughing. She said, like 99%. Have you had any kind of weird experiences or psychic type stuff where suddenly you're more intuitive than you were before, or even though it may be hard to determine before and after?
It's something I tried to test. I felt that with people in my family, close to me, my immediate family, my wife, that I could telepathically communicate. And there have been instances where I've tested this and, well, to my satisfaction, have proven it. Wow. Now, I haven't really developed, you know, an experimental protocol, experimental design where I would further, you know, test this ability in myself. But I have had some limited success in demonstrating this in terms of in communications with people close to me. Now, in terms of paranormal experiences other than telepathy, I can't really point to anything that happened on a regular basis that has occurred in my adult life. Now, I'm aware of Yvonne Smith's work, and that anecdote that you mentioned to me is going to prompt me to kind of look a little bit more deeply at some of her work. But I have to say I can't really point to anything in particular that would be a paranormal experience that I would think I had before my abduction experiences that I didn't have before the abduction experiences but had after them.
Yeah, because that goes to the Defense Intelligence Agency study of Skinwalker Ranch, which I say really didn't have much to do with UFOs. They said it was UFOs, but basically they wanted to see how do you put four bulls inside a trailer, through the metal of a trailer. How the woman takes the groceries and puts them in the cupboard and then goes to the next room, comes back, and all the groceries are back in the bag. That's the kind of weird stuff they were looking at, which they found happens around this type of stuff, that it seems to be linked. Like at ports, have you had any things where things appear and disappear, or?
No, you know, I mean, minor things that don't really impress me. Things falling off the shelf that shouldn't have fallen off the shelf. I've never had any inclination to connect those to my UFO close encounter or alien abduction experiences. They're just so far removed from 60%. Anything that I think would be in that category.
60% of experiencers have apportations and manifestations. If free survey, have you studied the free survey?
You know, how about out of body experiences?
Yeah, 80%.
I've had that.
Yeah.
I've had that as a child, as adult, even after I was married, you know. But again, not on a regular basis. But
I don't think anybody has.
You know, it makes me think back now, and yeah, I have things that have happened to me that I have to say would be paranormal. I can remember
the near death experience you haven't had, body,
but having my what I would think would others would describe as an astral body return to my physical body, that I recall.
Yeah, there's. I think it's 80%. Well, I can give you some of the things here.
Wow.
Expanded consciousness, 71%. Healing, you're healed or someone, you healed anybody else around you? 50% of experiencers claim that they can heal people or they have been healed. Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo astronaut, and Hernandez used to make the joke that if they had a dollar for every person that did every experience who did recce healing, they'd be rich people, because you know, you get that thing, or knew everything. 40% had at one point during their experience, they seemed to know the answer to everything. So that's the kind of thing. And the one I just discovered lately, because I wrote the book on people flying the craft, these 36 people came to me and claimed that they're flying the craft, was that they would describe this event where somebody was behind them and sort of guiding them. One guy was a U.S. Air Force retired colonel out of Iraq. And so I asked Whitley Strieber, I said, hey, Whitley, you ever have somebody behind you when you're on board the ship where they're sort of giving you indications and talking? You're not allowed to look behind you? And he said, like, all the time. And then he told about the craft. He wanted to steal a craft. And the being behind him started laughing telepathically. So there's these bizarre sort of things. And I guess it's the thing of linking them. But it sort of fits the pattern where it doesn't happen all the time. But you have these events like near-death experiences. 37% of experiencers claim they've had a near-death experience. And most of the ones I know have had two near-death experiences. And so what's the chance if it's a random event, and abduction is random, and near-death experience is random? What's the chances that 37% of people are going to claim they've had both?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it makes you think that there is some innate perceptual ability that the abductees have to see not only interdimensional beings, but a variety of paranormal beings or to have a variety of different types of paranormal experiences, precognition, telepathy, healing. You know, it makes you wonder if there is something to, again, the theory I've talked about regarding the aliens being interested in certain bloodlines, because there is something different about the people that they're interacting with. But I have to say, now that you make me think about it, I have to say that I would probably be in that 80%.
So where are you going with you've done the two books now, and you've thought about doing this experiment that you were thinking about, trying to develop an experiment where you can test something. Are you got stuff that you're looking at doing down the road, a third book in terms of researching? Because you've got some talents in terms of knowing how to run an experiment, how to set it up. Are you trying to add to the mix and solve some of the problems that people who don't have scientific backgrounds are going to miss?
Well, you know, the only thing I was thinking about seriously is, you know, as I mentioned, all my experiences are consciously recalled. I wonder if I could learn anything more by regressive hypnosis. And I might be able to uncover a lot of other experiences I've had, not only more fragments of the experiences that I report on, but experiences that I've recalled very little of consciously. So that's something considered. And if anything materialized from that, I would of course be quite motivated to report in the next book.
That's your book's doing fairly well, I heard, right? Your book is doing fairly well.
Yes, it's doing pretty well. It's certainly a bestseller, and bouncing back and forth between number one, but I think people are, as I say, interested primarily in the experiences. Many people are interested in the scientific analysis because that. You know, I talk a lot about how the Greys might have been genetically engineered, and you know, people with or without science background kind of find that stuff interesting. But I think I've definitely have seen an interest in both books. Thank you.
And your book, give me the sort of the three highlights that you want people to take away from your book that they can get out of your book. What's your main message that you're putting out?
That we're being visited not just by UFOs, by highly advanced non-human intelligence that are not only here on planet Earth, they're here under our noses, and they're experimental subjects. And what I'd like to know is what their purpose is, and how much can we learn about their technology in terms of the spacecraft they fly around in, and the technology that they're implanting into human beings that would allow us, if we can study this technology, to advance technologically, and in addition, develop defenses against the aliens in the event they become hostile. So I would like to see more scientists become interested in the phenomenon, because perhaps that they think, since a scientist is reporting his alien abduction experiences, that it might be a more legitimate subject to study. And my dream is that the government get more involved in a serious way in studying every aspect of the phenomenon, so we can learn as much as possible, because we don't know what the intentions of the alien beings might be. And therefore, we need to know as much as possible.
Yeah, I think you bring a lot to the table, because I always call the ufology field it's the Rodney Dangerfield of all sciences, where nobody gets any respect. And so when you get somebody who's got a PhD or a government official or the New York Times and comes out and is pro and saying we need to study this, then everybody seems to pay attention. So that may be one of the reasons why your book is doing so well, is that you've got something to lose. You have some credibility, and people feed off your credibility, because they want to know that they're not crazy and stuff. And you bring a lot to the table in terms of the fact that you're not just somebody off the street.
But my biggest dream actually would be if there were a lot more scientists come forward and report their experiences that may exceed the experiences I've had. I would, that's my greatest dream, to see, not just in America, but all over the world. There have been very few people write first person accounts of these type of experiences. And it would be great if they could come from the scientists of the world. And then I think we would move much closer to disclosure. That's just my opinion.
I agree. Well, thank you very much for doing the work you're doing and for the book. And we will put it up, and we will do what we can to push it. And when you have something else new, or if you want to interact with some scientists, I have some contacts with some scientists who are working in the field. And they do have this thing, you haven't been invited yet, but you may get invited to this. That's what they call it, the Invisible College or the Cosmic Club. And there are all of these names for it, where these guys are behind the scenes from different universities and backgrounds, and they don't really want to be known, but they want to interact with other people at their right level, scientific. And so you maybe we can get you into that little group, and you can interact.
But beyond Gary Nolan and Avi Loeb, there are people that really don't want to be, they don't want to go public. Yeah.
And I think a lot of it, I mean, you probably know that, I mean, a lot of it is going to have to do with, you sit back until you got the patent. I mean, you're not going to put your stuff on the table if you're, especially working right with biological material or whatever. I mean, everybody's trying to patent it. And I think a lot of that, the secrecy of these scientists is that sort of thing, where they're trying to gather material, but they don't want to, they're waiting to get it. Because I know Tim Taylor, I mean, I won't say how much money was on this one invention, but it was like major dollars. You just make your head spin. And so that's the whole deal, is if this technology is as advanced as people think it is, well, I mean, it's going to be worth a few bucks to whoever cracks it. And I think that'd be what part of the problem that the government has as well, is that you don't want to put your cards on the table for Putin and China and North Korea and stuff like that, because you may just give them the cards they want. Oh yeah, thank you. That's the piece we're missing.
Well, I'm going to ask the non-human intelligence for a download on zero-point energy, so I can solve all our energy problems.
Help put up.
I think I do quite well financially. If I can do that.
Yeah, help put up. Help put up with Dr. If you have your contact, help put up. He's curious. That's what I found. There's a documentary being done called The Aviary. And these are a bunch of high level intelligence, scientific people and stuff like that, that we're working together. And I think Hal would be kind of interested in talking to you and other people, because people think that they're different, but no, they're just at a different level. They may have a higher degree, or they may have a security clearance. They're trying to figure it out as well. So what they're trying to do is the same as you. They're trying to find someone at their level that knows, and everybody's reaching up to the next level. And I think I would agree with you that when you come right down to it, there's a lot of missing pieces that they really don't know. There's a lot of bravado about, we got this thing all figured out. And it's like, from what I heard, this thing of the core story was, we were being interacted by something. They know that they've got hardware, and they haven't got a clue how to back engineer the hardware. And that's, you know, they call it the core story. That,
well, it's maybe naive, and maybe again, another big dream is that we do have another agency, you know, where we can have a Manhattan project, something similar to a Manhattan project, where we'd have all the best minds with as much funding as they need, and we'd have a concerted effort to study all of these issues. But right now, it's just the people, you know, volunteering their efforts in relatively disorganized way. But again, I appreciate whatever they're doing.
And really we appreciate what you're doing, because you bring a lot to the table in terms of credibility that people can't just sort of slough you off as somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about. You know the scientific method. You've worked in the industry, and you know how things are done, and you know what evidence is, and what you know what we need, and how to run experiments. And so I think you bring a lot to the table. Keep it up, and whatever you need, I'll try to help you move along. And if you want introductions to people, I can give you introductions. I've interacted with a lot of people who are in the same boat as you. They've had, and a lot of people don't realize, a lot of these high-level people, Gary Nolan's a prime example. I mean, Gary Nolan's an experiencer. Hal Puthoff Sun's an experiencer. Eric Davis, the astrophysicist, is an experiencer. Jacques Vallée's an experiencer. And you go down the line, and they don't really talk about it, but they've all had the
experience. They haven't reported their experiences.
In a little bit, they'll sort of indirectly talk about their experience, but they don't really make it front and center. But that's how it happens. Is that's where, you know, the beings may be doing that, where they you have an experience you don't remember much, but you go down the rabbit hole, because that's how science advances, through awe and curiosity. If you're not curious, you're not going to do any scientific investigation. And they've got you as curious as can be, because it's like, what the hell happened to me? And that's what they do, is they trigger people. And people start going. So a lot of these guys will, I mean, I know their stories, but they don't really make it front and center. But yeah, a lot of these people, because you wonder why they're interested. Most of the people that are really pushing and are interested are people who've had some sort of bizarre experience that they just can't let go. And you know what it's like. It's like once you get down the rabbit hole, you can't get out. I mean, you couldn't stop if you tried, because they've got you. And that's how it works, is they want people curious, and they want us to figure it out rather than sort of landing on the White House lawn and you know, telling us how it all works. They're trying to get us to solve the problem. So that may be why they contacted you, but luckily they did, because you got a book that's getting out there, and that your book, even though you may not, nothing may be happening, the zeitgeist moves because more and more people are reading the book. And as I point out, you can go back to the idea where people may not believe there's UFOs at Area 51, but everybody in the world, in the darkest corners of China, knows what Area 51 is. Everybody knows what a UFO is. Everybody knows what a near-death experience is. They don't have to believe it or disbelieve it. And you have this idea that these ideas are floating up as just common knowledge, that people know what it is. Whereas in 50 years ago, nobody knew those terms. They had no idea about these things. And so it's this gradually raising the consciousness of everybody, so that when the New York Times puts out an article in 2017 and says the government's actually investigating this stuff, everybody goes, yeah, I knew that already. Because before then, everybody thought people would jump off bridges, people commit suicide, the stock market would melt down, and nothing happened because people were acclimatized to the idea.
I hope you're right. I hope they want us to advance to a point where we can join the community of you know, cosmic or galactic civilizations. Yeah. And that's, I mean, if you're sanguine, that's, I think that's the best thing we can hope for. But you know, what you said resonates with me. In fact, my wife said to me, she said, you were contacted maybe because they wanted you to write this book. Yeah, that was my purpose.
Yeah, and it does raise the.
I didn't want to do it, but they made me.
Yeah, the consciousness will be raised by your type of thing. That's why it's selling, is because you have the reputation, and people want, they always feel like Rodney Dangerfield. They feel like we don't get any respect. And so when they see somebody's got a PhD or somebody's a government scientist or something like that, it changes everything, because it's sort of, you've got bringing them credibility as well, that they feel better, and then they're more open. And same thing, you're gonna have, because you've come forward, you may have other scientists who decide, okay, if he came forward, you know, the world didn't end for him, and you may have other people moving forward, and it's a slow game. We, you know, in America, we want everything yesterday, but you know, we got to go through the learning process, and it'll eventually come. You can see it moving, because I've been in it 50 years, and I can tell you, it's not even close to what happened in 75. I mean, all the stuff we know now, nobody was talking about that stuff in 75. It was, in fact, in 75, if you had one UFO sighting, you were crazy. If you had two UFO sightings or claimed to have two UFO sightings, nobody would even talk to you. I mean, it was like, there's no way. It was
ridicule, ridicule, ridicule.
But but if you go back to science and you take a look at the skeptics are always wrong. They're wrong about the flat Earth. They're wrong about everything being solid. They're wrong about the sun going around the Earth. And perceptual reality, that's what I say with this paranormal phenomena. What happened to you, what happened to me, what happened to all these people, is if the world was the way people say it was, there would be no paranormal phenomena. The paranormal phenomena is telling you something is wrong. And that's what Gary Nolan says. I'm not interested in the 95% that falls in within the bell curve. I'm interested in the 5% outside the bell curve. That's where the Nobel Prizes are. And that's the thing, is you look at this odd stuff and say, why is this happening? This experience happened to me. It's happening to other people. Why is it happening? And if you could figure it out, you've got a Nobel Prize.
Right. Well, we look at the paranormal. Is it? I think some science fiction writer said that this generation's magic is the next generation's science and technology. Yeah. Arthur C. Clarke, I think, said that.
Yeah. And you and I get to play the game. I mean, it's like we want the answers, but then I always make, now, I mean, you make the analogy. It's $11,000 for a Super Bowl ticket, and if you knew the score of the game, you wouldn't buy the $11,000 ticket to go in. There's this curiosity thing, but you and I are in the stadium. I mean, whatever this is, you probably will admit, this is probably the biggest story of all times once we figure this thing out. And you and I got to play in the game. We're not, you know, some poor guy. We're in this, in the stadium.
That's exactly
playing in the game.
That's exactly how I feel. I mean, because again, I haven't had any traumatic aspects to my experience, and I got to be part of the discussion of, you know, the greatest story, or you know, for me as a Christian, of course, the greatest thing is that's happened is that Jesus came to Earth. But this is certainly up there with that. This would certainly be number two.
And he uses the same principle. I always say this is like the circus. It's like Jesus. If Jesus hadn't walked on water, fed 5,000 people, raised Lazarus from the dead, you never heard of the guy. You do the circus first, then you deliver the message. And that's what they're doing. They're doing this circus thing, and everybody's going, what is going on? How can you go through a wall and stuff like that? And later the message will come. But the first, they got to get your attention. That's what they're doing. They're doing this circus act.
I think that's as good an explanation as any I've heard.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for what you do. And let me know if there's anything I can do for you. And
I will.
There's people you want to talk to, and some, you know, a question that you want to know, I maybe put you in contact with some people, and we'll get it up. And I'll put on my podcast as well, which gets a few people listening on podcasts as well. So we'll try That's to get great. Your message out there.
Certainly on my part, on my end here, it was a pleasure meeting and talking to you.
Beautiful.
Very, very Thank informative. You.
Okay. Appreciate it. And hopefully we'll talk again.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.